our headlines, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a regional economic and security bloc, gives Iran full membership by a unanimous decision. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran supports diplomacy and multilateralism and rejects the policy of sanctions and pressure. Also, Africa is facing a 470 million shortfall in COVID vaccine doses this year after the COVAX Alliance cut its projected shipments. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. With our top story, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has officially given Iran full membership by a unanimous decision. Iran is now the ninth member state of the economy-oriented regional organization. The decision was made at the SCO's 21st annual meeting underway in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe. The two-day meeting began earlier on Friday. It brings together heads of states and top officials from member and observer countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is in attendance. He thanked the Shanghai Cooperation Organization for supporting Iran's full membership. The country joined the organization in 2005 as an observer state.
Another round of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's Heads of State Summit is being held in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe. Since its foundation 20 years ago, the Eurasian bloc has defined itself as a multilateral organization concentrated on fighting terrorism and extremism, ensuring regional peace and stability, and increasing economic cooperation. The SCO is the largest regional organization in the world in terms of population and territorial coverage. It is home to almost half of the world's population, and its members own nearly a quarter of the global GDP. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy with firm commitments to inclusive multilateralism.
The SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy, promoting multilateralism and fostering cooperation to address the most pressing peace and security issues in Eurasia. Your organization represents the largest combined population of any regional grouping in the world. Over 3 billion women and men, more than half of them children and young people.
The SCO members have made significant achievements over the past years in different fields. In 2021, the foreign trade volume of the bloc reached $6.6 trillion, which is 100 times as much as it was 20 years ago. The total economic value of the bloc also stands close to $20 trillion, more than 13 times higher than its initial amount. Moreover, statistics show between 2013 and 2017, the SCO institutions have made great contributions to the global fight against terrorism by preventing hundreds of crimes and arresting thousands of members of terrorist organizations. The successful interaction of the bloc's members has even resulted in the creation of a political term, the Shanghai Spirit, a concept that highlights the association's main principles: decision-making based on mutual respect, equal dialogue, and consideration of the interests of all member states. These principles have paved the way for the development of the organization and the expansion of its influence to such an extent that today, at the time of growing unilateralism across the world, one can consider the SCO a success story of coexistence of diverse states with different ethnic and cultural traditions.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic supports diplomacy and multilateralism and rejects the policy of sanctions and pressure.
Diplomacy is one of the means to ensure national interests of countries. It is efficient when all sides remain committed to their obligations in practice. Threatening and pressuring other sides weaken diplomacy.
Raisi made the comments at the 21st annual meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan. He called the sanctions a big challenge to the world today, saying the domineering states have been using them as a tool to impose their will over others. The Iranian president also underlined that the sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. He added the world is moving toward a new order that favors independent and sovereign states.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
Raisi further condemned the U.S. for causing chaos in the region, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said Washington needs to be held to account for what it's done in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. While rejecting foreign interference, Raisi noted that the sole way to establish security in the region is through regional cooperation. The lineup of Afghanistan's new caretaker government announced recently continues to spark mixed reactions in the Afghan society. While many welcome the formation of the new government, many others believe that such a government will not last a long time because it is not an inclusive one. Amin Alemi reports from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
The postponement of declaration of an inclusive government by the Taliban has faced mixed reactions here in Afghanistan. Many Afghans praise the Taliban for bringing calm and security for locals, but in the meantime, they are concerned about the fate of their lives due to political instability and widespread poverty and joblessness.
Security has been restored since the Islamic Emirate has taken power in Afghanistan. But we are facing serious challenges, especially when it comes to social and political issues. Most government bodies and banks are not functioning and factories remain closed.
This comes as the Taliban say, we are committed to form an inclusive government in order to bring a lasting political stability and peace to this war-ravaged country and want locals to be patient. The Taliban have already left out women from the cabinet lineup. This has led many to voice their concerns regarding the rights of women under the new government in Afghanistan.
Taliban need to win the hearts and minds of people, especially women, because leaving out the women from the government will spark international community refusal to support the new government. So they must take our demands seriously.
I ask the Taliban to try to win the hearts and minds of women instead of threatening us or depriving us of our basic rights. They must act based on true Islamic law. In this case, we will also support them.
A Taliban spokesman, Sohail Shaheen, announced recently that Taliban will protect women's rights within the religious law. Despite this, some major cities of Afghanistan, including capital Kabul, have so far witnessed demonstrations by women's rights activists as a reaction to Taliban's no to the presence of women in high-ranking government positions.
The international community is under growing pressures from the global public opinion to urge Taliban to establish an inclusive government by including women and respecting their rights in the society. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has accused India of pressurizing journalists and using illegal tactics against them in the India-controlled Kashmir. Journalists in Kashmir are facing frequent interference, policing, summons, and intimidations. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more from Kashmir.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference, and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy, the adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story, they are treating, as we call the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
Israeli forces have violently clashed with anti-settlement Palestinian protesters near the city of Nablus and the occupied West Bank. The regime forces attacked protesters on Sabih Mountain in the town of Beita following the Friday prayers. They used rubber-coated bullets and tear gas against protesters. Similar demonstration was also held in the West Bank city of Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil, where Palestinian and Israeli activists protested against the regime's confiscation and the cutting water supply for Palestinian villages. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for months over Israel's settlement activities, as well as the planned eviction of Palestinian families from their ancestral homes. Many Palestinians have been killed and scores wounded in the Israeli crackdown on protests in the past several weeks. The World Health Organization says Africa faces a 470 million shortfall in COVID vaccine doses this year because of cuts in shipments. Vaccines expected to reach Africa by the end of the year would be enough to vaccinate only 17% of the population there. That's according to the WHO's Africa unit. It says that figure is far below the 40% global target of inoculation. According to the organization, the International COVAX Initiative has been forced to cut Africa deliveries because of global vaccine shortages. The WHO says the shortages are partly due to export bans put by rich countries. It has warned that the lag in shipments to Africa could result in emergence of vaccine-resistant variants. That could send the whole world back to square one. The number of coronavirus cases and deaths is on the decline in Iran as the government steps up vaccinations across the country. Iran's health ministry reported over 17,000 new cases in the past 24 hours until Friday. The ministry also said that 364 more people died in the same time, bringing the total fatalities in the country to over 116,000. The vaccination drive in the country is also gathering pace as more than 41 million doses of vaccines have been injected so far. Nearly 170 towns and cities across the nation are currently categorized as very high-risk locations in terms of the coronavirus infection. In the Netherlands, people will soon need to have a coronavirus pass for visiting public spaces such as restaurants and theaters. From September the 25th, the Dutch should show a proof of a COVID vaccine or a recent negative test to enter those places. That came after Parliament on Thursday approved the measure introduced by the government. It was passed by a narrow majority. Opponents said the pass is an effort to stimulate vaccinations despite government's pledges that jabs would not be mandatory. Prime Minister Mark Rutte has said the Netherlands is still in a dangerous situation. He said the pass is needed to prevent a new wave of infections as almost all social distancing measures are dropped. France and Germany have introduced similar passports. Australia is going to have state-of-the-art atomic-powered submarines. The United States and Britain will provide what's necessary to build them. The trilateral deal has angered China, which believes it is part of America's anti-China efforts.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the new deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei.
That does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Today, unity is the biggest weapon for the Palestinians. May 7th, 2021. Muslim and Christian ulama should announce the act of normalization as haram from a religious perspective, and intellectuals and liberated individuals should explain to everyone the results of this treachery, which is a stab in the back of Palestine. Contrary to the downward movement of the regime, an increase in the capabilities of the camp of resistance is a sign of a bright future. An increase in defensive and military power, self-sufficiency in building effective weapons, the self-confidence of mujahids, the increasing awareness of youth, the extension of the resistance circle to the entire country of Palestine and beyond, the recent uprising of youth in defending Masjid al-Aqsa, and the simultaneous promotion of the Palestinian nation's spirit of jihad and innocence among public opinion in many parts of the world. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. The logic behind the Palestinian cause, which has been proposed by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been registered in the United Nations documents, is a progressive and attractive logic. Palestinian warriors can bring up the idea of holding a referendum with the participation of the main inhabitants of Palestine. The referendum will determine the political system of the country, and the main inhabitants, including the displaced Palestinians, no matter what their ethnicity and religion are, will participate in it. That political system will bring back the displaced Palestinians and will determine the fate of the foreigners inhabiting there. This demand is based on the common democracy accepted in the whole world, and no one can question its progressiveness. The Palestinian fighters should continue their legitimate and moral fight against the usurping regime until it is forced to give in to this demand. Move forward in the name of God and know that Allah will certainly aid those who aid His cause. The Holy Quran, chapter 22, verse number 40. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy.
You are alone, in hiding, and more than 50,000 occupation soldiers and 6 million colonial settlers are looking for you. Drones, cameras, dogs, sensing and tracking technologies in a very narrow geographical space, all looking for you. Still, you succeed in disguising after you had succeeded in snatching your own freedom from underground days earlier. This is not only an achievement, but rather a victory over an entity that used all its assets day and night to bring back part of the stature it lost due to your bravery. There is no room for sadness for your capture. There is only room for pride and great dignity. Heart-wrenching news came out from Nazareth on Friday night. Palestinian heroes Mahmoud al-Qardah and Yaqub Qadri were seized by Israeli occupation forces 6 days after they liberated themselves and exposed the weakness and fragility of Israeli technological superiority and military hegemony at the high-security Gilboa prison. Hours later, heroes Zakaria Zubaydi and Mahmoud al-Arida were identified and seized in North Palestine, leaving two more comrades free to the time of this report. Estimates of the Israeli security services indicate that the two heroes, Munadir Nafat, 26-year-old, and Ayham Kamamji, 35, have separated from each other, and that at least one of them is in the occupied West Bank. It would be impossible for Palestinians and their comrades all across the world not to revel in 6 detainees carrying out a daring escape from one of Israel's most secure and modern jails. Israel may have worked over time to demonize the 6 men as terrorists, but for us, they are among Palestine's finest and bravest foot soldiers. People received the news of the recapture of 4 out of the 6 heroes with a tear that preceded any other emotion and any words that were said. All Palestinians can identify with the plight of these men. Imprisonment is a rite of passage for much of the male Palestinian population. Estimates are that many hundreds of thousands have passed through Israelis' jails over the past 5 decades. Many are in jail awaiting trial, as were 2 of the 6 escapees. Others are in administrative detention, jailed without trial or even being told what charges are leveled against them. Detainees' rights are seriously abused. They are kept in overcrowded cells, have little contact with their families, and are often beaten or tortured. Every Palestinian will glory in Israel's humiliation, and every pro-Palestinian as well. Guards failed to spot the prisoners gradually widening a hole in the drainage system in their cell over many months. The six men moved undetected past a sleeping guard, and they planned a sophisticated getaway that foiled a police manhunt hot on their tail. But celebrations in Palestinian communities across the region and far beyond relate not just to the jailbreak. Every day that prisoners remain free is another hammer blow against the occupation. That is not just the way Palestinians see it. It is how Israel's officials and much of the public understand it too. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The heroic escape of six Palestinian detainees from an Israeli maximum security jail in the north of the occupied territories came as a strong slap in the face of the Tel Aviv occupying regime. The cellmates serving life sentences are believed to have fled through an underground tunnel from the Israeli detention center, which they had managed to dig over the past few months. This great act of liberation from the maximum security Gilboa prison confused Israelis, leading its regime and troops to launch a wide manhunt to re-arrest the Palestinian heroes. The whole world stood in awe at this great escape, as this operation was a one-of-a-kind achievement only possible because of Palestinian will and perseverance, despite the recapture of four out of six of these heroes. To discuss this very important issue with us from the occupied Syrian Golan is liberated Syrian detainee Sidqi Al-Maqt, who spent 32 years, where the sum of the years that he spent in the, and then he was liberated from the prisons of the Israeli entity. Israelis released the hero according to his own conditions to return to Majd al-Shams rather than to be exiled to Damascus. It's an honor to have you with us, Mr. Sidqi Al-Maqt. Now, the great act of liberation happened when six brave men lowered themselves through the floor of their communal shower cubicle into a pre-existing subterrane, which is a cavity that extended beneath the prison and towards its perimeter, allowing them to evade 40 prison guards, three watchtowers, two walls, two barbed wire fences, and a pack of sniffer dogs. How on earth did they succeed?
These six prisoners were able to bypass all these fortifications. It is worth noting that Gilboa prison was built in 2004, where Israel put all its past experiences of managing prisons inside Gilboa. They even hired experts from Western colonial powers, especially from the UK, benefiting from the British prisons in Ireland. Israel fortified the jail in terms of construction, fortification, procedures, and control. Despite all this, these six heroes were able to escape. I personally know three of the six heroes, while I myself was a detainee in Gilboa. They were able to bypass the daily security inspections and all the security cameras and the security personnel. They benefited from the cavity which was under their communal shower cubicle and then dug a long tunnel that extended for 25 meters. It is a miraculous operation, a nearly impossible operation, yet the heroes were able to bypass all these obstacles and were able to snatch their freedom with their bare hands. I extend my regards to these heroes.
Well, Mr. Sidqi, the six men were among about 7,000 Palestinians incarcerated in Israeli prisons after being either convicted or accused of military activity, meaning they simply were just practicing their full right of resistance against an actual occupation on their land. This great escape resurfaced the plight of the Palestinian detainees being illegally kept in Israeli detention centers. And now, after this escape, Israel is cracking down on all other Palestinian prisoners. How do you think will these Israeli provocations be received by the Palestinians in the occupied territories and elsewhere inside of Palestine? And what pressure do you think that the West Bank can actually exert to stop these provocations?
In the aftermath of each escape attempt, whether it succeeds or fails, and throughout the past decades, for prisoners have made scores of attempts. Some have succeeded, others failed. Following each attempt, the prison management took revenge against the prisoners. First, to vent their grudge and wrath against the prisoners. Due to their failure to foil the escape attempts, they vented their grudge and anger for having fallen into a fiasco. Now, this escape, along with other previous attempts, have mounted to a major scandal. Now, other prisoners, whether in the detention center where the escape took place or in other centers, are facing oppression. There are scores of detention centers. There are more than 4,000 Palestinian and Arab prisoners, 4,000 freedom fighters. Today, a war is being waged against them, a declared war from the prison management to confiscate all the past achievements. While we were in the occupation prisons, we have accumulated a lot of experience over tens of years. Through open hunger strikes, several achievements have been made in order to achieve minimum dignified human life. Only the minimum and nothing more. Now, the prison management is trying to take away all these achievements and to take the prisoners back to square one. This creates a stage of rage, wrath, and detention within the occupation prisons. Nowadays, the occupation prisons are more like a powder keg that can go off any moment. The prisoners now are planning to respond to this war through declaring an open hunger strike. They are expected to declare a strike soon, so that our people in Palestine and the others in our nation masses can support this strike. Now, this is an opportunity to plead to all the honorable free people of our Palestinian people and the Arab world and the free people of the world to stand by the side of our prisoners who are being subjected to the most hideous campaigns of crackdown and suppression inside the occupation prisons.
Well, Mr. Sidqi, many Palestinians celebrated this kind of a rare indignity of the Israeli security establishment, which directly governs more than 60% of the West Bank and has a lot of other control over the rest of the West Bank and Gaza, while it sadly coordinates its security issues with the Palestinian Authority led by President Mahmoud Abbas. Now, after the recapture of the four heroes in the 1948 occupied territories, do you think that the Palestinian Authority actually dodged a tough one here, given that according to its coordination policy with the Zionist entity, it would have been obliged to coordinate the manhunt against all six of them had they actually entered the West Bank?
The Palestinian people can no longer stand this authority nor the security coordination with Israel and all the laws and measures that are imposed on the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people longs for freedom, and this authority is the product of the Oslo Accords, which are now over, along with all their consequences. The Israeli occupation does not recognize any agreements or conventions, and the PA has reached a dead end. If these hero detainees had reached the PA territories, they would have caused a great embarrassment to the PA, because on the one hand, the PA cannot protect them, and on the other, cannot but detain them and hand them over to the occupier. This would have been a major quagmire. These prisoners moved to the Palestinian territories occupied in 1948, and there, four of them were arrested. The Palestinian people is currently boiling due to the consequences of this heroic operation. This operation has been a slap in the face of the occupier and proved how much this occupier is disintegrated and how much its apparatuses are irrelevant and inefficient due to this heroic operation. And when four of them were arrested, we felt a state of boiling, a severe state of boiling, that indicates a forthcoming intifada and future confrontation against the occupier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are certain human rights groups that describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to bring its use to an end. Might we actually be seeing another form of collaboration between the interior occupied Palestinian lands and the Gaza Strip to bring back the plight of these thousands of detainees out into the open again?
There are more than 4,000 Palestinian and Arab prisoners in Israeli detention centers. Some of them sentenced to life in prison. Some were sentenced to 10 lives in prison and 20 lives and 30 and 40 and 60 lives. Can you imagine? Sentenced to life 68 times. There are scores of detainees that amount to hundreds that have been detained for more than 30 years inside Israeli detention centers. There is a group of detainees that have spent 40 years behind bars. This is an opportunity for me to plead to our resistance fighters to work hard to liberate our detainees from occupation prisons. These international human rights organizations, which you mentioned, have never achieved anything. They are ineffective, and when we were detained, we never knew that these organizations ever existed, and we never received anything from them. These international organizations have never liberated one detainee. They have never helped one detainee out of solitary confinement. This is a big lie. We rely on the efforts of our Palestinian people and on the honorable resistance factions in our region to be able to liberate our detainees. The big question that remains now is, what will happen to the 4,000 detainees inside Israeli detention centers?
Mr. Sidqi Al-Maqad, liberated Syrian detainee from the occupied Syrian Golan, it was our honor to have you on with us to talk about the six heroes that took their liberty away from the Zionist occupation. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the new cabinet in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Will the new government of Najib Miqati be given public confidence? It is hard to say, given that this government seems to be representing the interests of the system that engineered the collapse of the country and manufactured this disastrous burden on the Lebanese society. It all came out crystal clear as the identities of the ministers were announced, the majority of whom will play a major role in the negotiations with the International Monetary Fund and the development of an awaited financial reform plan. Ministers clearly representing the interests of the central bank, international private banks, and financial institutions, and most notably the interests of the United States of America. A new Lebanese cabinet formed in this following report.
If last week's formation of the new government in Lebanon headed by Najib Miqati is a reflection of the continued power of the strong and its exploitation by the popular classes to strengthen its political and economic influence so that a very small group of beneficiaries can enjoy it, then it is certain that the ministerial formation expresses everything that contradicts the interest of the Lebanese to end the economic, financial, monetary collapse entering its second year. Between ministers who openly adopt the policies of the United States of America and reject economic cooperation with regional countries, adhere to the ideas of international financial institutions, and defend the interests of Lebanon's existing system of failure, people are terrified at how their future will be shaped by this new government's decisions. It is true that the destination was clear from the moment Miqati was assigned, one of the hardcore members of the system, but the issue took a blunt form with the announcement of the new ministers. The Lebanese people are wary of this government. Why? Well, because unless government headed by Najib Miqati takes a position on building a communal state that secures equal opportunities for all residents and provides them with basic services, then all hope has been lost. The essence of any solution for Lebanon is political, not technical, based on answering one question. Whose interests will the new cabinet defend? the interests of the banking and financial sector and all the beneficiaries of it who want to throw the burden of private bank losses on the shoulder of the general population, or the interests of the poor and middle classes whose deposits were stolen, their salaries lost their values, their purchasing power collapsed, and they were denied access to petrol, diesel, medicine, hospitalization, and housing? The basic step in addressing the crisis is to acknowledge its occurrence and to identify the ensuing losses and how they are to be distributed. That is the development of a financial reform plan. The objective of the plan is to show the losses in the Lebanese Central Bank and private banks, restructuring the banks in a way that enables them to exercise their role in the economy and return to performing their normal function, the most important of which is activating lending, especially to the productive sectors. Restructuring the public debt so that its sustainability does not remain a burden on all future generations. Determining the economic vision of the state and on the basis of which a new exchange rate system must be adopted to end the jaws of the collection of different exchange rates. This means that the criminal audit of the accounts of the central bank and the private banks must be launched, and Central Bank Governor Riyad Salameh must be held responsible for abusing the one job he had to secure the Lebanese currency.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Professor Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and professor of history and international relations from the Lebanese University. Thank you, Dr. Jamal, for being with us. Now, 2 years after the start of the Lebanese economic and financial collapse and a year after the tragic August 4th explosion, a new government has been finally agreed upon in Lebanon. Yet the names of the ministers who are on board with Najib Mikati's cabinet are least to say provocative, and since many of them had actually a hand in engineering the collapse that we are living today. Now, also, they are audaciously and openly pro-American policies, and they don't even try to hide it. Is this a Lebanese cabinet or an IMF / U.S. Treasury one?
Well, too bad it's mainly a U.S., a French government imposed on Lebanon, but it's not the first time in our history. Actually, all governments throughout our history, since independence and even before independence, were all formed by foreign powers, mainly international, Western ones, with mild intervention by Eastern powers or regional powers. So the government he formed is also consists of similar elements on one hand, and also they reflect the, let's say, the balance and the shares of the United States first, France second, and with an attempt by the anti-Western parties in Lebanon to have like a veto vote inside the government. But this leads us to the conclusion that this government will only pass time until the next legislative elections, which are due in next spring. Thinking,
but Prime Minister Najib Mikati said the day that the cabinet was announced that he would seek to start negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that the ruling system in Lebanon thinks that they are smarter than the institutions of financial colonialism and that they can actually refuse its dictations, while at the same time they can obtain from it a loan between like 4 or 8 billion, which by the way would change nothing in Lebanon. Not even a 10 billion loan would actually change anything. But what would be the remaining and the lower classes in Lebanon would be feeling this heat? So what is the point of seeking an IMF if we are not actually going to abide by its demands?
Well, first, the IMF, we've been abiding by IMF instructions since 1992, by the way, and even before. So it was all IMF policies that led us to this disaster, by the way, including appointment of so-called experts and technocrats like Riyad Salameh and Fuad Sanyura, who were presented as technocrats before unveiling their true face and being representatives of neoliberal policies imposed on the country in order to prepare it for the deal of the century, which is to normalize relations with Israel, sacrifice Lebanese national interests, so on and so forth. The debt, the national debt was cut off because our national debt was estimated at around 100 billion, but most of it was in Lebanese pounds, up to 70 or 80%. So now with the devaluation of the currency, our debt was cut off by more than 80%. So now if they get like 8 to 10 or $10 billion in loans from the IMF, they will, of course, use it not to channel it to productive sector, but into their pockets through the banking sector, which dominates the country. Mm-hmm. But, and this will give a breathing space that they could rely on in order to get elected in the forthcoming elections. So this is how they don't have a national plan of for national recovery and for restructuring the economy to the benefit of the whole country, but they want to use this money just for their own sake, for their own interests, and that's why...
This is what I want to ask about, the reform plan. A protective reform plan means re-examining the import policy, for example, in terms of what is allowed, what is prohibited, and maybe customs liabilities, whose goal should be to develop local production and increase the growth. Now, this measure, if accompanied by the passage of the general competition law in the country, would ensure the dismantling of the power of monopolies and cartels. But you are saying otherwise. And this would actually prevent their tyranny by ensuring the population's food, energy, health, and life security.
Definitely.
Now, the resistance... The Lebanese resistance has already begun with it, with the Iranian fuel. Will the government be able, or would the government want to actually go down that road?
Well, first, the government represents the interests of the dominant class, the rich, wealthy, rich and famous, okay? And they are bringing people from abroad with two nationalities, American citizenship and Lebanese citizenship, as if they are bringing football players to play in the
Champions
League.
Shouldn't that be illegal, though? Shouldn't that be illegal?
It should, but it's not in the case of Lebanon. Otherwise, all who would remain eligible to be elected to public office would be you and me, for example. Too bad. We don't have a law that imposes that the one who holds another nationality is forbidden from taking public office.
So in 30 seconds, you think that the government will not go down that road?
Definitely, because the government represents the interests of the financial class that is linked to international financial sectors and circles, and they don't want to go down the road to finance and subsidize a productive sector like industry and agriculture, but they want to boost imports through the way they did for the past 30 years. And this is why we, before talking about protecting the economy, we need to know what to protect. If we don't produce anything, so what would we be protecting? We need first to rebuild the productive sector and then see what we have to impose taxes on and what to allow into the country.
Thank you. Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and professor of history and international relations at the Lebanese University, thank you for this very brief yet very important piece of knowledge about what to expect from this new cabinet in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. Brought to you by Arab English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Sayyid. Assalamu alaikum, bro.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for introducing me. Habib Zata, yes, at your service.
Here's the thing. What is it with religion and fanatics?
Religion has nothing to do with fanatics.
Why is it that most fanatics and extremists are religious?
They're not.
Yeah, they are.
No.
They do it. Okay. No, I see what you're doing, Sayyidna. They do it in the name of religion.
Did religion ask them to do it?
I didn't say that. I said they do it in the name of religion.
They do it in the name of religion. I will go kill Brother Habib in your name, mm-hmm, if you've asked me to kill Habib. But if you haven't asked me.
No, it has.
I'm like, oh, you know what? Sister Zainab, she has a grudge with Habib, so I'm going to kill him.
Yeah, that's because doing that will it in satisfy her. That would be doing it in my name, even though I didn't ask
you
to do it.
To do
yes,
it.
That's what I'm saying.
So, okay. That's
I'm
exactly
not safe
what,
here.
That's exactly what you're saying. So I'm saying all these fanatics who do things under the name of religion, they never understood religion to begin with. Let alone do anything under their name.
It has to do with their upbringing.
They have to read religion, see
really?
What religion wants from them.
Really? You think it has to do
them.
With upbringing?
Either sickness or upbringing.
What? Okay, now elaborate.
See, when you look at, like for example, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he was raised in a tough manner.
Was
then
he abused?
Goes,
so you're saying he's a victim of abuse?
He was a victim of abuse, and the teachings that he took, I think that the upbringing that he had...
Okay,
affected.
So here is the thing. He was raised by extremists,
yes,
as well. Where the hell did those extremists
ignorance.
Come from?
Ignorance.
Why is it that religion sparks the most extreme ignorance in a human
religion
being?
Never
no,
does.
It doesn't have to do with religion. Excuse me. There are
explain
governments.
Yourselves.
There,
explain
there
yourselves.
There are governments.
Go first, or Brother Habib wants you to go.
Brother Habib, you go first.
If I could just say this, and then I'll say Abdullah talked the entire show and just sit down, right? I don't care. I just want to say this, that religion... governments, inshallah, atheist governments, mm-hmm, I don't care. When it goes to an extreme, when some people become too zeal with it, mm-hmm, when some people become, they see that their desires are being fulfilled with it, mm-hmm, they will go to an extreme to keep it. They will go to an extreme to defend it. They will go to an extreme against anything,
what
anything
kind of
against
asset,
it.
What kind of assets did the likes of Daesh secure from themselves from being extreme idiots?
You have to go back to their sources and where they get their sources from and look at the people of those sources, how they were feeding themselves with this, you know, fake ideologies.
Are you saying these are material assets?
Material assets, of course.
So are
being
you saying that Daesh was
power,
funded?
Being the judge of judges, being the king of judges, being, for example, a person with so much cash and funding, being the person that is known to be the most knowledgeable person. Because why? This is my path. This is how I preach. This is what I teach.
I think Daesh would be the worst example to use because Daesh is just, first of all, let's agree, it's not even an Islamic movement. It's
absolutely,
it's made by America.
They're as confident as it gets.
Now, when we say that Islam or religion is the source of extremism, there's something wrong here, okay? Now, let's look at some personalities. Hitler. Was he a religious person?
No,
Mussolini.
Not at all. He was a fascist.
Was he a religious person?
No, I believe he was a Marxist. I don't know. I'm not
so
very
they
good
not they weren't religious. So Christianity or Islam, for example, religion itself, if it's true from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it has nothing to do with extremism or killing people. The Quran says, "Man qatala nafsan," kills one soul, "kannama qatala an-nasa jami'an," as if he killed the entire humanity. And Allah says,
"What about those verses that Allah says, 'Waqataluhum'?"
No. All these ones, Allah,
kill them,
Allah.
And bind
if you look
them.
At the ayat, if you look after it and before it, Allah is talking about specific events, specific times, specific places. That when you are under attack, you have the right to defend yourself.
Uh-huh, okay.
All right. So these ones, you should not generalize them. They were specific. So anyone who is an extremist has nothing to do with that faith that he belongs to because that faith is pure. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَوَيْلٌ لِلَّذِينَ يَكْتُبُونَ الْكِتَابِ. Allah says, woe be to those who write the book with their own hands, وَيَقُولُ هَذَا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ. And they say, this is from God. This is where all the Christians and Muslims who fought the Crusaders, for example, who killed in the name of Jesus Christ, and the Muslim who killed in the name of Islam, they wrote their own books. And they misled their own people. So can I call this misleading or
but
this
again,
new
again,
religion
see,
a religion?
This does not resolve not. This question. This does not answer the question as to why is it that most fanatics draw their inspirations from quote-unquote religion, be it the original religion of God, the original divine pure religion of God or not. Why is it that most extremists and fascists?
I'm telling you, that's what I'm saying to you. It's easy. It's important for people to understand that if it is the true religion, you don't have fanatics. If it's not true religion,
we're not talking
calling
about
it religion is wrong.
We're not
calling
then,
it religion
okay,
is wrong.
A cult. A cult.
A cult.
A doctrine.
If it's a cult, anyone
a dogma.
Could kill when he has a cult. What
Why?
Does that have to do with us?
That's what I'm asking. Maybe, you know what? Maybe this question is a little bit
It's
a
human nature that if you look at humanity from Adam to now, human nature, they've been killing one another for the sake of money, land, wealth. That's just their nature, to kill and try to divide and conquer and force people to believe Marxism and all this. For example, the Soviet and the communists in China. They're trying to force people to believe in their ideology.
What brings
Brother
them
Habib,
their gains?
So it's
Brother Habib,
that's a human nature. It's got nothing to do with religion.
We all agree that Daesh is as far as it... Because I'm talking about them because they're the most contemporary form of extremism we've seen, right? We all agree that they are as far as possible from Islam and its teachings and its core and its spirit.
Why?
What is it that they do in the name of Islam that contradicts so much with the actual Islam? I need to clarify for people, why is it that this extremism isn't Islam?
It's firm. Well,
what do you think?
The
Zee?
Idea is, give me one action that they've done that goes side with Islam. Is killing people is Islamic? Is taking women as slaves is Islamic? Mm. Is killing other people from other religions is Islamic? Is it invading other countries is Islamic? Which
well, there
is Islamic?
Are a lot of...
This is what they've done, right? So they invaded a country. They killed those who opposed them. They took their wealth. They took the women and children of other people as their own, as Islamic term. What is the term? Ghanima and
Booties.
Ima. They were like literally Ima because, you know, the laws of Ima.
What
and
does
they
that
do,
mean?
Like a slave.
Slave.
Like
right.
I can take a woman and I could do whatever I want to her.
Bond's woman.
And she's mine. Mm. Right? So which part of this is Islamic?
We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Thank you so very much for being with us on Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two very special guests, Brother Habib and Brother Abdullah. We're talking about religion and fanatics.
So all the Ghazawat, even, like
all
I said...
All the wars of the Prophet.
Either the Prophet the is battles. Done, the war done with the Prophet or Ma'soom. Even the Futuhat al-Islamiya, the Islamic openings.
Defending a Da'ashi person, for example, it would state that we don't have this in ideology that it has to be a Ma'soom that goes into, that starts the war. We our leader, whoever he is, their leader was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
And I say to you, then you're not a Muslim because Islam says,
That's the context that they have.
I already mentioned that. They didn't yaktubun al-kitab bi-aydihim, those who read the book with their own hands. We already been through this. So that stated. So anyone who is not following an imam.
So Sayyidna, you're saying that the premises on which they based their movements, their conducts, their expenditures was faulty, was not Islamic.
Of course.
Therefore, any gains and any results that they achieved from it is invalid.
Of course.
In the eyes of Islam.
Of course.
So because they had the audacity, the inhumanity to fight innocent people, kill their husbands, and try to spread their messages and teachings...
By force.
Therefore, whatever happens in result...
It's not Islamic.
Is also not Islamic.
Yeah. So that's why I always say when people say, okay, all the extremists are Muslims or religious, I'm saying, dude, differentiate between what religion is and what these people are doing. Whatever they're doing, you can call it a cult, you can call it whatever you call it, but do not call it religion.
Mm.
Because religion never
can't say that. We can't say that, all right? Religion can... people worship Pikachu. That's their religion.
Okay, you can call it a religion if you like. Right. I, as a Muslim, when I talk about Islam and I want to defend my own religion, I say my religion, which is Islam, all these acts that have been done under its name, it's in fact not Islam. It's something else.
Say
call
that,
whatever religion
you
want
to
call it.
When I defend, when I want to say what he said, I don't say Islam. I say Shiaism Islam. I'm sorry about that. Another thing that I want to say, is that, first of all, let's understand this extremism.
What is extremism?
See, sometimes we might see that some people might see the Shia fiqh as extreme as well.
Sometimes,
you can't deny it.
Sometimes, Brother Habib, I think you're an extremist.
I am an extremist in your eyes.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I don't disagree with that.
If you hold your belief to a certain extent, that's extremism anyway.
But aren't we supposed to die for our beliefs?
We are supposed to. That's what I'm saying. So the word extremism.
Oh, or maybe we're supposed to die, but we're not allowed to kill for them.
No. So the thing is, we are meant to be anything. Like anyone, in whatever field he is, if he's taking a passion, he's an extremist.